1 Samuel 1:1 through 2:11. The first talk in a series on 1 Samuel was presented by David Crabtree on November 5, 2006 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
I'm going to start in on 1 Samuel this week. I'll be teaching for several weeks. I've decided that I want to teach through 1 Samuel. More history. We've been working through the Old Testament narratives. We've done Genesis, Exodus, Numbers, Joshua, and now we're skipping Judges. I want to jump into Samuel. I think history is important, and in particular, the Old Testament history is important. God has a long history of history with the people of Israel, and I am convinced that it is very important background for understanding the New Testament. The New Testament authors had absorbed that history. They were very familiar with it, and they're drawing upon that in the writing of the Gospels and the New Testament. And I'm convinced that we can't fully appreciate who Jesus was and what he did unless we understand that history. Furthermore, it seems to me that understanding history as a whole requires that we understand the history of Israel, the Old Testament history. And I think it's the key to understanding what's going on in the present and what's coming in the near future. So for those reasons, I think this stuff is very important, and I enjoy working through it. In the book of 1 Samuel, we are going to see Israel be transformed from a group of loosely united tribes into a unified kingdom that is occupying all of the land that God had given to Abraham. And so we'll look at, first, it will introduce us to Samuel, who will then anoint Saul as the first king of Israel, and then later David as the next king of Israel. So this is the beginning then of the kingdom that was established by the people of Israel. Now let me give you a little bit of background. What transpired between Joshua, which we finished a few weeks ago, what transpired in history between Joshua and the events that are recounted here in 1 Samuel? In the conquest, Joshua led the people of Israel into the promised land, and as it describes in Joshua, they conquered to the south, they conquered all of the strongholds in the south, then they moved to the north and conquered all of the strongholds in the north. Then it was just a matter of mopping up and firming up the control of the Israelites over all of those areas. But before those mopping up operations were done, the people were divided by tribe, assigned different portions of this land for them to settle in. And then those tribes were responsible for gaining control of that area that they had been given. So there was much left to do when Joshua died. Judges describes what happened in the intervening 200 years. There are about 200 years that the tribes are settled into the land that was given to them, that was apportioned to them by Joshua, and they were unable, and it's not clear, maybe unwilling, to fully take control of the areas that were given to them. And as a result, they came under pressure from their neighbors, and in control, they were controlled. Occasionally, then, God would send along someone who would rise up and provide leadership that would lead his tribe or a group of tribes into overthrowing the power of one of the oppressors. So that's the period of the judges. The judges are the ones that rose up and for a period of time led the people of Israel against their neighbors or their oppressors. So that provided provided temporary relief from the oppression. And generally speaking, those were local champions, that they would champion the cause of a local area to fight off their oppressors. Meanwhile, throughout this 200-year period of time, the Israelites did not do what they had been told to do. They had been told to maintain the laws and the commandments that God had given them, and to remain a distinct and separate culture from the Canaanites that surrounded them. They did not do this. To a large extent, they assimilated the culture of the Canaanites around them. So what resulted was a mixture of obedience to the commandments that God had given and capitulation. Hypocrisy was the result. And Judges ends in the last verse. It says, "In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes." And that's the theme that you hear repeated through Judges, is everyone did what was right in their own eyes. People did not submit to the laws and commandments that God had given them, but rather they acted as seemed right to them, which was wickedness. So that characterizes the 200-year period of time between the death of Joshua and the events of 1 Samuel. Chronologically then, the action of 1 Samuel starts in about the middle of the 11th century B.C., so about 1050 B.C., more or less. At this time, the most potent enemy of Israel is the Philistines. And I've mentioned this before, but I will review it for you so that you can get it right on the test. The Philistines apparently were part of the Sea Peoples. And the Sea Peoples is a movement that develops about between 1400 and 1200 BC. And it is a group of people that lived on the coasts of the Aegean. Some of them are Greek, some of them are not Greek. Some of them come from the west side of the Aegean where it's Greek, and some came from the east side of the Aegean where it was not Greek. Some of them come from the shores of the Black Sea. But for reasons that are unclear to us, they moved out from their homelands in their ships and would go throughout the Mediterranean raiding other people. It's a phenomenon that is extremely reminiscent to me of the Vikings. The very good Vikings who loved steamed cod. Very, very similar to the Vikings who moved out and went into throughout Europe raiding. And in the beginning, they would go and they would raid, and then they would, for just a period of time, then take their loot and go back home. But as time went on, they realized that was a lot of commuting for that amount of loot. So they would raid and stay longer. They would maybe camp for a year or so, carrying out a lot of raids, and then they would take all of that home. And then there were some groups of Vikings that would go and decide, well, we'll just go and stay and carry out our raids from a location much closer and much warmer than is ours. And a similar thing happened with the Sea Peoples, that they would go raiding into various areas, but in some cases, they would actually move from their homeland and settle someplace that's closer to more wealth. The Philistines fit that pattern to a certain extent. They went, this particular tribe of Sea Peoples was called the Pelishti. And according to Egyptian writings, the Pelishti invaded the delta area of Egypt in their boats, And with great difficulty, the Egyptians were able to defeat them. But it was so difficult to defeat them that the Egyptians decided we should put these Pelashti to good use. And so they took them captive and they settled them on the southern shore of Palestine, thinking that if anyone's going to invade Egypt, they're going to come down through Palestine. Palestine's that land bridge of it's a strip of land that allows one to get from Mesopotamia to Egypt without going through extremely harsh desert conditions. So if anybody's going to attack Egypt, they're going to have to come through Palestine. The Egyptians knew that. So they said, the Egyptian pharaoh decided, let's put this very warlike people on the southern coast of Palestine so that if any invaders come down, they have to come through these Pelashti. And they have to fight against them. So they were settled on the southern coast of Palestine, and they mixed there with the local population, which were Canaanites. So the Pelashti then assimilate, and they become culturally indistinguishable, for the most part, from the Canaanites. The only significant difference is they maintain their warlike spirit. Those become known as the Philistines, and we get the word Palestine from Pelashti. So the rest of the Mediterranean came to know that area as the land of the Pelashti, or the Philistines. So they were just really coming into their own at the time of the first Samuel begins. They have become firmly established there. They have grown, developed five cities: Gath, Gaza, Ashkelon, Ashdod, and Ekron are all the city-states that were developed by the Philistines on the southern coast of Palestine. So throughout, as we go through 1 Samuel, we will keep running into the Philistines, and that's the background on who they were. So this is the situation in which Israel finds itself. It's been given these great promises by God that it is going to be a people without number. They will occupy the territory that was given, that was promised to Abraham. And they're kind of there, but they haven't established control of it as they had been commanded to do. And they seem to be unable to throw off the power of their oppressors, their neighbors. And it's in that context that we have this first account in Samuel, which I think is very important, because we have in this a microcosm of what is going to happen throughout the narratives of 1 and 2 Samuel. So let's look at it. Verses 1 through 8 of 1 Samuel 1. Now there was a certain man from Ramathaim Zaphim, from the hill country of Ephraim, and his name was Elkanah, the son of Jehoram, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zuph, an Ephraimite. And he had two wives. The name of one was Hannah, the name of the other was Penaniah. And Penaniah had children, but Hannah had no children. Now this man would go up from his city yearly to worship and to sacrifice to the Lord of hosts in Shiloh. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were priests to the Lord there. And when the day came that Elkanah sacrificed, he would give portions to Penaniah his wife and to all her sons and her daughters. But to Hannah he would give a double portion, for he loved Hannah. But the Lord had closed her womb. Her rival, however, would provoke her bitterly to irritate her, because the Lord had closed her womb. And it happened year after year, as often as she went up to the house of the Lord, she would provoke her. So she wept and would not eat. Then Elkanah, her husband, said to her, "Hannah, why do you weep? And why do you not eat? And why is your heart sad? Am I not better to you than 10 sons?" So we have a distressing situation here. Elkanah is a man born to a priestly line, a prominent priestly line. He is very religious, and as we see, he's very compassionate as well. But he has two wives, and the situation is that one wife, Penaniah, has children. Her name, by the way, means coral. His other wife, Hannah, has no children. Her name means grace or gracefulness. And there is tension between the two, as is common. In the Old Testament accounts, when there are multiple wives, there's almost always tension. I think that's an interesting observation. It's a warning to us. And that it is important to note that it's not just the situation that Penaniah has children and Hannah doesn't, and therefore she feels bad, but rather she's actually provoked that Penaniah goes out of her way to rub it in that Hannah has no children. And that is a source of great, great anguish on Hannah's part. Now, Kana goes on a yearly basis. He goes to Shiloh. Shiloh was then, this is before Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. Shiloh was the place where the temple was located. It's the place where the center of worship in Israel took place. So Elkanah goes there for his yearly sacrifices. He does this very faithfully. And Hannah goes along. It points out that Eli's two sons were serving there. That's going to be significant when we get to the latter part of chapter 2 a little bit later. That's a little bit ominous. They turn out to be bad guys. They would make the sacrifices, but when they would make the sacrifices, because of the situation, because of the anguish that Hannah is experiencing, Elkanah gives double portions to Hannah, presumably as in hopes of a double blessing on Hannah. But it says, but the Lord had closed her womb. It makes it really clear here that the source of the barrenness is God himself. This is a God-inflicted barrenness that she is experiencing. Nobody can do anything about it. It's in God's hands alone. And this is so distressing to Hannah that she can't, according to Elkanah, her husband, before that, so she wept and would not eat. She is truly in distress over this. And it's Elkanah, it's interesting, his response to her, Hannah, why do you weep and why do you not eat and why is your heart sad? Am I not better to you than 10 sons? There's nothing that he can do about the barrenness. But he's trying to be as kind to her as he can, and he would like for his love for her to be some kind of substitute for her lack of children. But she can't overcome her distress because of this. So it's an agonizing situation. It's one I think that we can all identify with. Next section, with verse 9. Then Hannah rose after eating and drinking in Shiloh. Now Eli the priest was sitting on the seat by the doorpost of the temple of the Lord. And she, greatly distressed, prayed to the Lord and wept bitterly. And she made a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if thou wilt indeed look on the affliction of thy maidservant and remember me and not forget thy maidservant, but wilt give thy maidservant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and a razor shall never come on his head. So Hannah has presented, they've presented the sacrifices, and Hannah is at the temple, and she is praying. Next to her is Eli. Eli is apparently quite old and is no longer serving in the temple, but he comes and he sits at the doorpost of the temple. And we'll see that that's We'll see that later. We see him in the same spot later on. So he apparently comes to the temple and just sits in the doorpost. And she is distressed, feeling her pain, and she cries out to God and prays to him and weeps bitterly, probably crying out for help, that God would somehow change the situation and do away with her barrenness. And in fact, she makes a vow, if you will give me a child, if you will give me a son, I will do two things. One is I will turn that child over to the service of you all the days of his life. And secondly, a razor shall never come on his head. And that's apparently indicative of taking the Nazarite vows, that if, that he would become a Nazarite, and Nazarites upheld certain rules throughout their life. One was to not shave. A horrible thing. So that's the vow that she has made before God in order that he would give her a son. Now the response, verse 12. Now it came about, as she continued praying before the Lord, that Eli was watching her mouth. As for Hannah, she was speaking in her heart. Only her lips were moving, but her voice was not heard. So Eli thought she was drunk. Then Eli said to her, how long will you make yourself drunk? Put away your wine from you. But Hannah answered and said, no, my Lord. I am a woman oppressed in spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but I have poured out my soul before the Lord. Do not consider your maidservant as a worthless woman, for I have spoken until now out of my great concern and provocation. Then Eli answered and said, go in peace, and may the God of Israel grant your petition that you have asked of him. And she said, let your maidservant find favor in your sight. So the woman went her way and ate, and her face was no longer sad. So Eli sees her, and she's praying and weeping. So it is drawing attention, his attention. But he concludes from observing her, her mouth is moving, but no words are coming out. He concludes from looking at her that she's drunk and chastises her for that. But her response is, no, that's wrong. That's not the case. I'm not drunk. I'm just distressed. And she doesn't tell him exactly what the problem is. She just says, do not consider your maidservant as a worthless woman, for I have spoken until now out of great concern and provocation. So it's this barrenness and the oppression that she feels from Penaniah's comments with respect to her. That's what's really distressing her. But otherwise, she doesn't tell him what the problem is. Eli is apparently both sobered, no pun intended, and impressed by the response of Hannah. That I suspect what he is detecting here is a spirit that is humble and respectful towards God. In any case, his response is, go in peace, and may the God of Israel grant the petition, your petition you have asked of him. So he extends a blessing to her. And that has a significant impact on her. She leaves, and she is no longer sad. She is no longer distressed. So immediately, she finds relief. Next section. 19. Then they arose early in the morning and worshipped before the Lord and returned again to their house in Ramah. And Elkanah had relations with Hannah his wife, and the Lord remembered her. And it came about in due time after Hannah had conceived that she gave birth to a son, and she named him Samuel, saying, because I have asked him of the Lord. So they go back home. She has relations with her husband. She conceives and gives birth to a son, names him Samuel, which means God, God, a heard of God, heard of God, in honor of the fact that this is a response to the prayer that she had made to God. Next section. Then the man Elkanah went up with all his household to offer to the Lord the yearly sacrifice and pay his vow. But Hannah did not go up, for she said to her husband, I will not go up until the child is weaned. Then I will bring him, that he may appear before the Lord and stay there forever. And Elkanah, her husband, said to her, Do what seems best to you. Remain until you have weaned him. Only may the Lord confirm his word. So the woman remained and nursed her son until she weaned him. Now when she had weaned him, she took him up with her, with a three-year-old bull and one ephah of flour and a jug of wine, and brought him to the house of the Lord in Shiloh, although the child was young. Then they slaughtered the bull and brought the boy to Eli. And she said, O my Lord, as your soul lives, my Lord, I am the woman who stood here beside you praying to the Lord. For this boy I prayed, and the Lord has given me my petition which I asked of him. So I have also dedicated him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he is dedicated to the Lord, and he worshiped the Lord there. So the next year, the child is just a few months old, what, 2 or 3 months old. Elkanah is going to go up to Shiloh, as he does yearly. But Hannah says, I'm not going to go. I'm going to stay here. In fact, I'm not going to go back to Shiloh until the child is weaned, at which time I will take him there to become a servant of the Lord. Elkanah's response is, do what seems best to you. And then he says, remain until you have weaned him. Only may the Lord confirm his word. And I'm not sure what that means, but I assume that it means may God fulfill the request that you had made of God with respect to having a son and that son serving God and becoming a Nazarite. May God carry through with that vow and that promise, his affirmation of that vow. Hannah keeps Samuel until he's weaned. We don't know when that was, probably about age 3 at this time in Israel. That seems to have been the time when children were weaned. Once he is weaned, then she goes up to Shiloh, takes a bull, a 3-year-old bull, and other offerings, and presents him there to Eli the priest. It must have been quite an occasion when she comes in with the boy, and presumably Eli remembered this event when 3 years earlier, or whatever, 4 years earlier, when she had been praying in the temple and he had accused her of being drunk. I suspect that was a memorable event. Now she comes back with this son. She had not told him that what she wanted was a son, but now it becomes clear that this son is the fulfillment of the promise of the request that she had made of God. And so this boy is very clearly a response to her prayers and the one that Eli had asked, that the request that Eli had asked be granted. So she gives him over to Eli, and he is then dedicated to the service of the Lord in Shiloh there with Eli, completing the vow that she had taken. In chapter 2 then, first 10 verses, Hannah gives a song of thanksgiving, and this is quite a remarkable song. I'll read through the whole thing, and then I'll make some comments about there are about 4 sections in here, and I'll make comments on those 4 sections. Then Hannah prayed and said, My heart exults in the Lord. My horn is exalted in the Lord. My mouth speaks boldly against my enemies, because I rejoice in thy salvation. There is no one holy like the Lord. Indeed, there is no one besides thee, nor is there any rock like our Lord. Boast no more so very proudly. Do not let arrogance come out of your mouth, for the Lord is a God of knowledge, and with him actions are weighed. The bows of the mighty are shattered, but the feeble gird on strength. Those who were full hire themselves out for bread, but those who were hungry cease to hunger. Even the barren gives birth to seven, but she who has many children languishes. The Lord kills and makes alive. He brings down to Sheol and raises up. The Lord makes poor and rich. He brings low. He also exalts. He raises the poor from the dust. He lifts the needy from the ash heap, to make them sit with nobles and inherit a seat of honor. For the pillars of the earth are the Lord's, and he set the world on them. He keeps the feet of his godly ones, but the wicked ones are silenced in darkness. For not by might shall a man prevail. Those who contend with the Lord will be shattered. Against them he will thunder in the heavens. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth, and he will give strength to his king, and he will exalt the horn of his anointed. Okay, let's look at each section. Verse 1 is the first section, and here it's just a proclamation of Hannah's sense of vindication, that she has, through God, she has been vindicated. She says, my heart exults in the Lord, my horn is exalted in the Lord. And the horn is symbolic of strength or power. So her power, to the extent that she has strength or power, that is through God. That has been given to her and raised to the fore by God. My mouth speaks boldly against my enemies. There's not that sense of being cowed by her enemies, that God has come through, she's been vindicated, and she's not a lesser person. Why is all of this true? Because God came through and rescued her. God provided salvation. So that first verse is just a proclamation of a sense of vindication. Verses 2 and 3. Here she establishes that God is worthy of our humble and obedient trust. She proclaims that God alone is righteous. There's no one like him. He is set apart like no other. He's incomparable. He is like a rock. He is trustworthy. You can absolutely count on him. Boast no more so very proudly. Do not let arrogance come out of your mouth. She's saying, don't be arrogant before God. Don't take his power lightly. Don't underestimate him. For the Lord is a God of knowledge, and with him actions are weighed. He knows what's going on. No one escapes his notice. And God is the judge of actions. Verses 4 through 8, the theme here is God delights in displaying his power by crushing the strong and granting success to the weak. So it's that inversion of those who look like they're losers, look like they're down and out. It's those very people that God likes to use as a display of his strength. And he lifts them up such that they have success over those who would otherwise look like they would be the successful ones. And he talks about that in several forums with respect to warfare. He says the bows of the mighty are shattered, but the feeble gird on strength. with respect to economics, those who were full hire themselves out for bread, but those who were hungry cease to hunger. And then with respect to her particular situation, childlessness, she says, even the barren gives birth to seven, but she who has many children languishes. So there's that inversion that she's talking about happening in various forums of life. And all of this is done by the God who controls life and death, the God who controls all of our destinies. And he's the one who brings down to Sheol or raises up. And then he summarizes, the Lord makes poor and rich. He brings low and he also exalts. God's the one who does all of that. It's not our own strength. It's not our own worthiness. But rather it's God who's in control of all of that. And in fact, God is in control of everything as he proceeds through. He reiterates, he raises the poor from the dust, he lifts the needy from the ash heap to make them sit with nobles and inherit a seat of honor. For the pillars of the earth are the Lord's, and he set the world on them. It's making clear that God's in control of everything that happens in this world and is therefore very much in control of wealth and poverty, health and sickness, etc. Verse 9 then, she claims that God is the defender of the righteous. He keeps the feet of his godly ones, but the wicked ones are silenced in darkness. That's the fate of the two groups. For not by might shall a man prevail. There's nothing that we can do to change that which God sets out to do. It's not by our might that we rise to a position of prominence or wealth or health, and there's nothing that we can do to secure that into the future. That's all a gift from God. Then in verse 10, he talks about God's establishment of a kingdom on earth. It says, those who contend with the Lord will be shattered. Against them he will thunder in the heavens. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth, and he will give strength to his king, and he will anoint the horn of his anointed. So it's a hint here of a kingdom that will be established by God, that will be one that acts in accordance with God's principles, one in which the wicked are punished and the righteous are justified. So in this song, she talks about her situation, but she's also talking about the situation of Israel in general. That Israel is this nation that God put together, and despite all odds and despite all appearances, it looked like it would be impossible. But Israel rises up to become a kingdom that establishes God's rule. Okay, there are a couple of things that I want to talk about with respect to this passage in a little bit of length. The first is the vow that Hannah takes. Are we to view this vow as faithlessness or faithfulness? It turns out well. She takes a vow, God grants her request, Samuel is born, and Samuel rises up to be a very important tool for God in the history of Israel, and a very righteous man. But how it turns out can't be the way we decide whether what she did was right or whether it was wrong. There are many wrong things that were done that turned out well. In fact, we count on that. God taking wrong things and making it turn out well. I don't know about you, but I am frequently tempted to make vows to God. Now, when I want something really badly, I try to think, what could I do for God that would get him to do what I want him to do? And over the years, I've come up with some pretty good ideas. But it's an attempt to get leverage on God, because what I always feel as I stand before God is leveragelessness. How do you get leverage on God? It takes a very long lever, and I don't have it. But I'm often tempted to do it, and I'm looking for something that I could offer to God. But there are two things that always come back to me when I think about making a vow. And the first is, when it comes down to it, what could I do for God? I mean, it's rather pathetic to think that I would be doing something for God that would be of significance to him, such that he would change his mind. And the other is, if it's what God wants to do, why extend the, why try to find some leverage? Why make a vow? Why not leave it at let God's will be done? So is resorting to a vow necessarily faithlessness? Is it giving in to faithlessness and thinking, I've got to do something to get God to do what I want him to do? And I thought about this quite a bit. And I reached the conclusion that it's not necessarily indicative of faithlessness. It seems to me that she was in a situation of distress, and being in a situation of distress is not faithlessness. In fact, Jesus himself was distressed in the Garden of Gethsemane and driven to falling down before God and asking that this cup pass him by. So distress and agony are not indications of faithlessness. It's not the case that if we just had better faith, stronger faith, we wouldn't be distressed and we wouldn't agonize. Rather, distress and agony seem to be a part of the human condition. We all experience it. We all will experience it many times throughout the course of our life. So whether a vow is an act of faithlessness, it seems to me, depends on the spirit in which the vow is given. And I think we see from what Hannah vows that we can kind of see the spirit behind her vow. The issue is not whether I have a son or not. The issue is, are the righteous vindicated? Are the righteous shown for what they are? Or are they eternally condemned to suffering? Hannah's vow is, give me a son, and I'll give him back to you. So the son is not the issue in a sense. The issue is vindication. And it's not her vindication as much as God's vindication. That God defends the righteous. That's what's at issue. So I think in the vow that she's making, she's recognizing that, and she wants vindication of God rather than vindication of her, more specifically. So it's actually a rather remarkable vow that she makes, and I think shows quite a bit of maturity and understanding. The next issue is the significance of this story for 1 Samuel, and I've alluded to it, but this little vignette is kind of a prelude to all of the events of the next 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel. Now, what we're going to see is Israel in chaos and helplessness, which corresponds to Hannah's barrenness. And it looks like the neighbors are all picking on Israel. They're oppressing Israel. And it looks like Israel is not capable of fulfilling the promises that God had made with respect to Israel. How can Israel be the chosen people of God? That's laughable to the neighbors. And yet, over the events of these two books, it shows how slowly Israel forms itself into a kingdom that's unified, strong, and possesses the land that God had given to them. What is the significance of this story for us? It is the case that God has done and continues to do wondrous things. A couple of weeks ago, Jack argued that God is not currently performing signs. I don't think that that's in tension with what I'm claiming here, that God has done and continues to do and is doing now wondrous things. They may not be signs. They may not be the kind of thing that is specifically designed as a display to people at large that God is who he says he is. But nevertheless, they are the kinds of things where God comes to us in individual circumstances and provides us rescue from those, alleviation from the sufferings that we're experiencing. And all of that is like a reminder that in the end, the righteous will be granted eternity and the wicked will be punished. That which is good and true ultimately will win out, and that which is false and wicked will not. And as we look around at our life, that's sometimes hard to see. It really looks like the wicked win and the righteous lose. But that's on the short term. And every once in a while, God, in his own way, breaks through and gives us a little indication that eternal truth is true, that righteousness will win out and God will be vindicated. We all find ourselves suffering from one kind of oppression or another from time to time. And it is not and in distress. And it is not wrong to pray for relief and pray hard. But we have to realize that it may or may not be granted, that relief. Even if it is granted, it may take a very long period of time. Notice in these Old Testament stories how long God is willing to allow people to suffer their particular distress. With Hannah, we don't know how long it was, but it can be counted in years. It's a number of years that she experiences this. It takes years. It can take decades. We have to realize that God is accomplishing lots of things in history and lots of things in our lives. And they are significant things. And it's through our experiences, through God's working in our lives, he's operating on our souls. He's removing the cancer from our souls. That's a serious operation. And those kinds of serious operations take time. And only he knows how long those take. But he is certainly willing to allow us to suffer a lot of pain and distress as he works on us. But it may suit God's purposes. It may be that he will never do away with that source of distress for us. We may have that source of distress our whole life. But he may change it. It may take a long time, but he may change it. And he may give us relief. Because he likes to break in and remind us sometimes of those eternal truths. But when he does so, it's important to keep in mind that those are vindications of God and his promises, not so much vindications of us. I love the verse in Genesis where it describes Joseph's response to his brothers. I've mentioned this before and I will mention it again. But Joseph had been cruelly treated by his brothers, sold into slavery, and as you know, was taken down to Egypt as a slave. Then years later, when he's reunited with his brothers, and then his father dies, his brothers are scared to death because at this time, Joseph has an enormous amount of power and he can do anything that he wants to his brothers. So his brothers are scared to death. And Joseph is hurt that they're afraid of him because he has forgiven them completely long ago. He has no intention of seeking revenge from them. And his response to them is, "You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good." That there are two intentions in those acts of oppression towards the righteous. One is the evil intention of the perpetrator, and it is indeed evil. It can be. But the other intention is the intention of God, that all of that is being done for God's purposes and for your good. And that's something that Joseph fully understood, that all that was accomplished by his suffering was a phenomenal good. It was a transformation of his soul. And that's priceless. It doesn't mean that what his brothers did wasn't evil. It was. But Joseph doesn't have to worry about getting back at them. That's God's job. God will settle those scores. He can be fully forgiving because nothing happened to him that was bad. It may have hurt, but it wasn't bad. So we can always be, and we ought always be, forgiving in those situations. Our oppressors may mean it for evil, but God means it for good, and nothing is out of God's control. It is truly a remarkable God that we serve. If we look at ourselves honestly, we see how weak and pitiful we are. And it is very fortunate for us that God delights in showing his strength through our weakness, and that God has chosen to come and save those who are the weak and the unpromising and the humble. And we can have confidence that that's the way the story ends, that the righteous in the end are vindicated. That's what God's doing in history. Questions or comments?
I find the I find your distinction of asking God to vindicate himself a very useful distinction in understanding what David does in some of his more bloodier psalms, like 109. Mm-hmm. That's helpful for me to understand how a righteous man can ask for those things. It's helpful also with a lot of the Old Testament, with each individual's relationship with God. Like, they have these moments where I grew up with a Christianity where that wasn't quite sure what to do with Jacob wrestling with God. Like, you're kind of like, well, that's pretty, for lack of a better phrase, pretty ballsy going after God and you're going to wrestle with God. That's, I don't know what you're thinking. Like, but again, your description of Hannah not only explains how that can be a righteous thing that God would want in us, but also helps me understand what, in a sense, Job was doing wrong, given that Job seems to be more interested in God coming down and vindicating him. So I really appreciated that concept. It's very foreign to me, but I do like how you explained it. So thanks.
And it can be a difficult balance. I mean, to sort out in ourselves, what do we really want? Do we want ourselves to be vindicated, or do we want God to be vindicated? And we can say we want God to be vindicated. In fact, we want ourselves to be vindicated. Those are hard to sort out, but I think it is an important distinction.
That was a good question, Toby. I was hoping you could maybe comment on, maybe the cultural significance of names. And I'll tell you my thinking. So there's these two, you mentioned offhandedly the names of, meaning cruel, no, quarrelsome.
Quarrel.
Just
quarrel. Sea quarrel.
Oh, really? C-quarrel. Well, that's, that changes everything. Thanks for making that distinction. I would say never mind, but maybe it's still an interesting question of how you would name your kids back then. I mean, yeah. I don't know.
That is an interesting question. And God is authoring, through the writers of the Bible, He is authoring Scripture. But He's also authoring history as a whole. And so He is in the position to be able to superintend what people are named. And so that in His story, those names can be significant and have a significance that Hannah's parents couldn't have foreseen. But as history plays itself out, those take on a significance. I think that happens. Now, why Coral for Penaniah? What significance would that have? I don't know. But Hannah, you can see it there. Because Hannah, as it turns out, is indeed gracious. I mean, that's... As I think about life, if there's one quality that I would like to have characterize my life, it would be living life gracefully, living life graciously. To have that ability to keep things in perspective and live in a way that is edifying to everyone that you come into contact with, That's a wonderful picture, as far as I'm concerned. And Hannah, it seems to me, exhibits that kind of quality. And that's phenomenal. So the name becomes really, it's very, very appropriate for this particular character. And I don't think that's entirely accidental.
What kind of came out through your comments is something I kind of almost think about. Looking at Luke, when he wanted to go into Asia and his comments, but God hindered it, and then Joseph, and then Paul praying about his problem or affliction, that many times I think that the reason why we go through some of these things is basically God wants us to develop a certain attitude or to go to do a certain thing, but... You know, either we don't want to listen to reason, and then sometimes we have to be pushed. And I think I see a little bit of this in Hannah, is that she is a woman that God maybe had recognized would actually do this, would dedicate a son. But he had to use this affliction of closing up her womb for her to realize this. And for it to come about. And I see that in my life too, because when my mother had cancer and dealing with her, it just, gosh, it just really changed me. And I often tell people, I said, it's an experience that I wouldn't give anything for, but I wouldn't wish it on anybody.
God's purposes are very complex. It's hard to sort that all out and know exactly why He's doing what He's doing. But what we have to come to trust is that whatever it is, whatever His complex purposes are, and it's not just purposes in my life, there are other people in the universe, and he's got a big puzzle that He's working out, how he's going to accomplish His purposes in everybody's life.
To sort of address your question about the vow and going along with your thesis of that, it seems to me that the whole poem in chapter 2 is really a statement on Hannah's part about the sovereignty of God and how much He's in control. And whether she realized that before or whether that this whole story was the process where she discovered that, it seems that she's, at least in the poem, she's very aware of that. And certainly in that process, God is vindicated, but it also goes to the question of whether the vow was an act of faithfulness or trying to leverage God. I mean, how do you leverage God if God is sovereign? Well, you don't.
It's, Understanding that God is in control, understanding the depth of my sin, understanding, I mean, there are any number of things that at one level you do understand that, but through experiences you come to a new level of understanding of that same thing. And there seems to be no end to the depths at which you can understand those kinds of things. And it's really significant.
Thank you. That's been very helpful. The end of this thing is incredible. Have you given any thought to where, I mean, Larry's talking about, I can see where a lot of this song comes just out of a recognition of the sovereignty of God, but that he will give strength to his king and will exalt the horn of his anointed.
Where does she get that?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's.
I mean, this is a prediction of the end of all time out of the mouth of Hannah right here. Right. This is incredible.
Right. Well, what's here is the story of history.
Yeah.
And all of it's right here.
Yes, she almost seems like an inappropriate prophetess. She comes up with a phenomenal conclusion out of just a personal experience. I wanted to ask a question. Historically, the Jewish people, led by Joshua, appear to be the aggressors. They go into the promised land after 40 years in the desert, and as you brought us up to date on the history of the situation, you said that they went after their oppressors, the Canaanites, etc. How is it that you see the Canaanites as oppressors when this Jewish nation had been wandering for 40 years? They really hadn't any contact. There must be another reason historically of why you presented all those peoples in the Holy Land as oppressors, justifying the Jewish nation to be aggressors toward them.
Well, they were given the land by God. They move in, so they are being the attackers there to people that they've never met before. They are able to defeat and take control of all the central, all the major cities in the land. But then what seems to happen is they're assigned their allotments and they go home and build their farms. And they don't want to mess with warfare anymore. They don't want to think in terms of this ongoing activity that needs to be carried out. And it's during that time then that neighbors and people within their midst, Canaanites that are still in Palestine, are able to get their act together and mount a counteroffensive, if you will. And it's at that point that they become the oppressors of the Israelites that are there.
I've got a question concerning this testing of God. When Hannah, she wasn't trying to vindicate herself, but she was asking God to vindicate himself. And I was always taught that testing God was a bad thing, and it was showing a lack of faith there. Could you talk about that?
Well, I wouldn't characterize this as testing God, what she's doing. What she's doing is making an appeal to God to show in history that things will turn out the way God says they will in eternity. That is, righteousness will be lifted up and wickedness will be destroyed. And what she's asking is, just give us a glimpse of that reality and do it in my particular situation, please. But I think that because of the nature of the vow, you can see that it is not, the spirit of it is not primarily me, because she gives up the child, and that's what's really interesting.
It would be more trusting of her just to let God continue doing what he was doing, not make this vow, not make all of that.
Right, and that was kind of my thinking as I started looking at the passage, but that's where I modified my thinking as I thought about it more, because I don't know that we can be that categorical about it. It all depends on the nature of the request and the nature and why you're making the vow. And I think in her case, Her interest is not in self-vindication, but in the vindication of God and his promises. And in that case, that's not testing. It has to be given. It has to be in the spirit of a request rather than a demand. And that's critical. That she has to understand that if God does not do this, then he knows better. So it's not this, if you do it, then I'll like you, and if you don't do it, I won't. It's not that kind of situation. Okay, we need to stop. Thanks.